If you were in Hawaii in the summer of 2015, you no doubt remember the record-breaking temperatures, the unrelenting humidity, broken by few trade winds to bring even the semblance of cooling. Now, imagine periods like that increasing. It could well happen, according to a study out today from an international group of researchers and students coordinated through the University of Hawaii. The team compiled data from over 1,900 cases since 1980 where the heat has killed people. According to the study, 74% of the world's population will be exposed to heat waves by 2100 if carbon gas emissions continue to rise at their current levels. Researchers say even if emissions are aggressively reduced, 48% of the world's human population will likely be affected. Lead researcher on the study, UH Professor Camila Mora, joins us now. Hi there.
Hello. Thank you very much for
having
me.
Good to talk to you again, even about this and perhaps especially about this. This is a very frightening study to a lot of people who remember what Hawaii was like even just two summers ago. And to think about that kind of heat wave increasing around the world, and you cite a number of them in your study, the one in Moscow, the ones in Europe that we've seen, other places where people, and we're talking about thousands of people, have died.
Oh, that's just what happened here 2 years ago, 3 years ago. It's just a sneak peek of what the future has in store for us. We are talking that for Hawaii, for the little bit of data that we had, the entire summer could look just like that. But we don't have to go too far into the future. I mean, the fact that we found 1,900 cases when people had died because it got to be too hot is already mind-blowing to me. You know, and those cases are happening all around the world. And just as we speak, there is a heat wave in California. There was a heat wave in New York last year. There is one in Spain as we speak. And this thing is just not something that will happen later on. This is already coming upon us.
Coming upon us and accelerating. And that's the scary part. I mean, you say that even if we're able to mitigate some of what we've already seen, that approximately half of the world's population will still be affected. That's pretty damning.
Yes, I just don't really understand humanity. I mean, we are abusing nature. You cannot expect after such a huge abuse not to have consequences to it. And unfortunately, our abuse on the climate, on the planet, has been so massive that we run out of good choices for the future. For heat waves now, our choices are between bad and terrible. Bad in the sense that if we do the best we can, you still have 50% of the world's human population exposed to deadly heat waves. But if we don't do anything, it will be terrible because you will have 70% of the population. Again, you can just not expect that after doing such a bad things to our planet for so long, we are not going to pay the consequences of it. And today, again, 30% of the world's population is exposed to that. Right now, as we speak, there are many places that are facing the consequences of this excess heat.
Because you make the point that even if emissions are aggressively reduced, and use those words advisedly, if, in fact, they are not aggressively reduced, if they're just somewhat reduced, you're really saying to us that, folks, it's going to be north of 50 and maybe south of 70, aren't you?
Yes. I mean, not doing anything will be just devastating. I mean, yes. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's just like, as a scientist, there is little I can tell you. I wish I could give you better news. But again, the change has been so massive already that there is just no way for us to reverse this. Think of this like you are going at 100 miles per hour in a highway. You stop the car right away. That car is not going to stop right away. The same thing is happening to the climate and to our planet, that we are changing it so fast that even if we decide to do the best we can right now, this thing is just going to keep moving forward. So I don't think things will get better than they are right now, because 30% is exposed to deadly heat, but they could get a lot worse if we don't do anything.
When we talk about, you know, people feeling the effects of this kind of deadly heat and people literally dying from these heat waves, you're talking about the human body cooking itself from the inside.
That for me is the definition of torture. You know, imagine what it will be for you to die from the slow cooking. Dead by a slow cooking, that's the definition of dying during a heat wave, when the temperature gets to be too hot that a lot of your organs start malfunctioning. Think of it as a sunburn, but inside your body. And a lot of organs, unfortunately, start failing upon you. And what we know, for instance, is that one of the things that kills you the most commonly during these heat waves is your guts. It turns out that when it gets very hot, the heart starts pumping blood from the core to your skin so that the sweating evaporates, and that's how the body cools down. By doing so, it deprives certain organs of blood. The one that you don't need during a heat wave is your guts. By doing so, the lack of oxygen in the guts generate these conditions in the guts that are very anosmic. There is no oxygen there, and it breaks the lining of your guts. So everything that you had in your guts now goes into your bloodstream, and that's when things get bad for the human body. Imagine
poisoning yourself.
It's poison. That's just one of the mechanisms, but there are many other ways that you can die from these things during those heat waves.
We have heard about certain populations being particularly vulnerable. You're talking about all populations.
That's right. So anyway, this is like a marathon. Once you get into a heat wave, this is like a marathon. And obviously, not everybody's going to finish it, but some people will finish it, you know, the ones that had the capacity to do it. But some people, their body might just give up. And the people that probably will give up the earliest will be the elderly. The reason being that their hearts, at that moment, the heat wave is demanding the most from the heart. You know, the heart is pumping hard to push the blood to the skin so that it comes back to the body cold. So many people just don't have the heart to withstand that stress. And that's the reason why you find that most of the people that die during these heat waves are normally people that are elderly.
Looking at all of this, which is truly frightening for a lot of people, because this is not something, as you say, that we haven't already experienced and experienced greatly. And in Hawaii, that we've experienced in the very near term, two summers ago. What kind of mitigating measures do you think that we have to begin to take, or that we can begin to take, to even increase our chances somewhat of not seeing 75% of the population of the world experiencing deadly heat waves?
I mean, I think that this is pretty bad, but I don't think we cannot give up on the solutions to fix this problem. Personally, I think that there are the solutions are at three different levels. The first level is at the government level, in which governments need to invest on finding out those alternative sources of energy so that we move away from fuels, right? And governments need to see that as an investment rather than as a cost. That's the problem today with many of these governments, that they see that as a cost. What they should be looking at is that as a possibility, because imagine the country that cracks the production of that electricity, of that energy. It will make that country a superpower by the next morning, because everybody wants to move away from fossil fuels. So that's the first level of solutions that need to be implemented. But at the city level and at the state level, governors and mayors need to start developing plans to make their cities greener. You know, we need to start planting more trees, because we have discovered that those trees on the cities make the cities colder. And unfortunately, by us cutting trees, what we make is the cities absorb more heat and make things worse.
We've seen buildings that have had, you know, certain coatings put on the roof to be able to reflect the heat. Places that you mentioned that where trees are being planted to be able to mitigate some of the heat, create a little bit more shade. But, you know, these things are going to take a little bit of time to roll out. You mentioned looking at other alternative energy forms. We have some of those. The point has been made that we just aren't accelerating the use as quickly as we could.
That's right. That's the reason why you need to have the government investing on those kind of stuff. Think about that, like the cell phone. You know, back in the day when the cell phones just came out, they were super expensive. And now you can just buy one and dispose it by the end of the day. And that was because there was a massive investment in making those things more affordable. So that's kind of the investments that we need at this moment with those alternative sources of energy.
Let's say, for example, that there's only minimal investment in that way. And meanwhile, people are looking at the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. You know, kids who are little today will be around most likely in the year 2100. What do you tell parents?
No, well, I don't think we have to tell. That's another thing that I think is an issue with climate change, that we think about the future. I think that this is already a reality. I just think about the fact that 1,900 cases we found around the world where cities got too hot and people died from this.
Right, but what do you want them to do, Camila? What do you want people to be able to try to approach, if not at a governmental level, because that's going to take time? What can an average person do?
There are a lot of things that individual people can do. So I told you the government level, the city level, and then is the individual level. People like you or me, we need to start consuming less things. You know, we buy a lot of stuff that we don't need. And what we fail to realize is the fact that everything that we use like that is CO2 that we are putting in the atmosphere. Building that single product that you bought that you don't need took a lot of energy to make it, to put it here for you to use it and potentially waste it. So there is a huge feedback of CO2 that is associated with these things that we buy that we don't need. So as individuals, we need to become more aware of that. Here in Hawaii, though, I think that people had a very unique responsibility to start helping restoring ecosystems, though. Here, Hawaii has a huge opportunity for us to become carbon neutral, and people can help on those kind of stuff, you know, and it's something that we should start feeling proud of, like being sure that we are making Hawaii a better place.
I wish we had more time to talk. Perhaps we'll have another opportunity soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you for coming back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Camila Mora is an associate professor at the UH Geography Department in the College of Social Sciences. His current research focuses on the interlinks between biodiversity and human welfare. He's the lead author of a study published in Nature Climate Change. It predicts that 74% of the world's population will be exposed to deadly heat waves by 2100 if carbon gas emissions continue to rise at current rates.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Paddle Sports on Maui, providing sustainable ecotours with a dedication to using business for environmental and social change. HawaiianPaddleSports.com.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Hawaiian scholar Noinoi Silva. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa. Ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolau, uhawaiti.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're considering the influence of Native Hawaiians in the old Oregon Territory. Here's the story. In 1811, there were 24 Sandwich Islanders among the crew of men sent by John Jacob Astor to establish his trading post at the mouth of the Columbia River. For decades to follow, Hawaiians continued to work in significant numbers for the Northwestern fur trapping companies. At Fort Vancouver and other posts, Polynesians were valued for their skills as swimmers, navigators, boat builders, fishermen, and strong manual laborers. Generally, they signed 2 or 3 year employment contracts. Most returned to the islands after completing their term of service. But a significant number settled permanently in the Pacific Northwest. This morning, we'd like you to name the first recorded Polynesian person to travel into the Northwest interior. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Noinoi Silva is professor of Indigenous and Hawaiian politics and language, Hawaiian language at UH Manoa. She was the first to document Native Hawaiian resistance to U.S. annexation in petitions signed by 95% of the Native population here. Noinoi spearheaded translation of early Hawaiian newspapers, a rich repository of culture, politics, and intellectual life. We welcome her on the publication of her new book, The Power of the Steel-Tipped Pen, Reconstructing Native Hawaiian Intellectual History. Great to have you here, Noinoi.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Great. Well, your book here is, it explores the writings of two men. One, Joseph Kanepu'u from Kalawao, Molokai. The other, Joseph Poipoi from Kohala, Hawaii. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yes. Joseph Kanepu'u is the older of the two. Mm-hmm. He was born in about 1824, Molokai, and then he settled here on Oahu. Mm-hmm. Mostly self-educated. He went to the mission school and on Molokai until about middle school age. But then he continued to self-educate and was asked by his neighbors here on Oahu to become a school teacher. So he did that, and then he began writing for the newspapers. So he contributed Moloka'i versions of familiar stories that were quite different than the versions that, say, the better-known Samuel Kamakau wrote.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. And the other gentleman, Joseph Poi Poi.
Joseph Moku Ohai Poi Poi, as you said, was born in Kohala. His father was G.W. Poi Poi, and I haven't been able to ascertain what those initials stand for. It turns out his father was also known as G.W. Kahiolo, and wrote the very first mo'olelo ever published in the papers, which was Kamapua'a. So he, Poi Poi, followed in the footsteps of his father and far exceeded his father in terms of writing. He went to secondary school at Ahui Manu Catholic Seminary, which eventually turned into St. Louis and Chaminade.
And he settled on Oahu as well.
Yes, he settled on Oahu as a boy.
He was an attorney.
And he trained. He was first a school teacher, and then he trained in the law in Kohala, and then here on Oahu, and became an attorney. So he wrote many, many different genres. He was a political reporter. Mm. He translated laws into Hawaiian, and he wrote many of our most beloved epics.
And a lot of this came out in the newspapers, which were such a vibrant resource in those days. Tell us a little bit about that culture, the newspaper culture.
Well, the newspapers, by the time Kanepuʻu was writing, there were several newspapers being published. Some were independent.
So that's the mid-1800s. There are already several newspapers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So some were church papers. Mm. In the beginning, all papers were missionary papers. And then an independent paper came out in 1861. And Kanepuʻu was one of the founders of that paper. And then later on, he wrote in several other newspapers. So the newspapers are important because it was there that public opinion was influenced, possibly formed. It was there that people debated. They were also the site where people recorded deaths and then the mourning and condolence chants and letters. So that's where we find out biographies of people. Huh. That was where our literature was published, with a few exceptions. Almost all of our literature was published as serials in the Hawaiian language newspapers.
These are Hawaiian language. About how many newspapers were they? They were on all the islands.
Well,
right?
Most newspapers were published in Honolulu.
Ah.
But they were mailed out, and there were regular mail deliveries to all the islands. And so everybody got them from Niihau to the Big Island. And then in 1906, there was a paper established, at least one, but the one I know most about, Hoku o Hawaii, was established in Hilo, and that turned out to be the last newspaper. It lasted for 42 years.
Whoa. So
yeah.
It kind of captured the vitality of, I guess, intellectual life at the time in Hawaiian language.
Yes. Yes, uh-huh. Absolutely. And all different genres in our language are in there. Geography, riddling, songs.
Riddling. Oh, my gosh. That must
riddling
be so complicated.
Riddling is a very big, very big.
How does that work?
Well, someone would come up with a riddle and send it
How
into the letter.
How many chickens crossed a row?
Well, they were more complicated
yeah, I'm sure.
than that. They usually took the form of, for example, they used fish as a metaphor for everything. So they'd say, my fish was born in the ocean and comes of age on land, and it can slip through your fingers or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then people would write in and propose answers, and eventually it turns out that the answer is salt. So
uh-huh.
that's just when.
Okay.
So they were, you know, like that. Some were puns, like many of ours in
of
English.
Course.
So, yeah, everything was in there. Politics, many political debates, genealogical debates were huge and went on, would sometimes go on for years.
And was there a reflection of the layers of meaning that spoken language had?
Most definitely. In fact, it became even easier to do that on the written page because in speaking, as you know, Hawaiian has short and long vowels, for example. And it also has the glottal stops, which weren't assigned a consistent letter to represent them until the mid-20th century. So prior to that, you know, the words would be written without any indication whether it was a long vowel or a short vowel. So you could take a word like lalau and lalau, so lalau is to wander and lalau is to grab. So you could do a lot of puns.
Go a lot of places with that.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, what did it seem to you that their world was like? How was their world different from ours?
Well, for one thing, it was a very Hawaiian-dominated world.
What's that like?
It's everybody spoke Hawaiian, almost everybody. People who moved here, this was our country, and that was our language. So anybody who moved here and wanted to do business or just get along, if you lived here, you needed to learn our language. So this was a Hawaiian language world. So my great-grandparents from China and from Portugal and from the Netherlands, they all spoke Hawaiian.
Mm. I almost feel like I'd feel closer to nature speaking Hawaiian for some reason. Would that work that way?
Maybe, because so much of the figurative language, just as in English, a lot of figurative language is taken from nature, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's so exciting to discover another world through language. I mean, we know how language shapes our intellect. Certainly a whole other world opening up in your exploration of the intellect of that time.
Yes. Something I tell my students all the time is that in different languages, none of the categories match. So you really have to think about, or people do imagine things in a different way. For example, it might be surprising to think that there's no word for hand in Hawaiian because your lima goes from the tip of your fingers to the top of your arm. That's your lima. So the category just simply doesn't match. And everything's like that. So when you're in that world, you imagine things differently.
Oh, it's so great to be able to just tip our toes into that world with you in this book, The Power of the Steel Tip Pen. Thanks so much, Noi Noi.
Thank you, Noi.
Noi Noi Silva is Professor of Indigenous and Hawaiian Politics at UH Manoa. Her new book, The Power of the Steel Tip Pen, Reconstructing Native Hawaiian Intellectual History, is out on Duke University Press. Find out more about the Indigenous Politics Program, and you can find it with this interview on the HPR website.
Support for The Conversation comes from the Aloha International Piano Festival. Fabio Bedini and John Nakamatsu perform music of Schumann and Brahms, 4 p.m. this Sunday at UH Orvis Auditorium. AlohaPianoFestival.com.
An idea to counter increased automation is getting some Hawaii government attention. With technology threatening to end jobs, Hawaii could be the first state to study a government-supported guaranteed income. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton has a reality check. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Beth Ann.
So, I mean, this idea that has just, you know, burst all over the place in social media and, you know, the last couple of days, is intriguing a lot of people, that, that Hawaii would come up with a potential way of doing this. But very clearly, we're saying now this is only a study of it. Yet the mere idea that we're looking at it has taken a lot of people by surprise. What was the genesis of this idea and this resolution?
Well, if you look at the resolution, it spells out a lot of the technological changes that are really affecting the way we live, affecting the way we work, and affecting the workforce and the economy and job opportunities. And Representative Chris Lee, who is a sponsor, talks about a lot of these things. We have things like self-driving Ubers replacing cabs in some places, self-checkout lines. The resolution mentions that IBM's Watson computer can actually offer basic legal services better than a lawyer. And it also mentions 3D printers, which now cost about $500 and, you know, lets people basically buy products at home and manufacture them at home at a pretty low cost. So all of this combines to say, let's consider something to help people out.
The idea of how do you find a meaningful existence if what you thought your job was going to be or what your job has been is eliminated through automation is getting a lot of people to stop and consider this. We did a series last fall, The Last Job in Hawaii, and yet many of the industries that we talked to said, well, you know, the economies of scale for this are just not there for Hawaii. It's going to take a while for that to happen. Are they really behind the curve, according to the people that you're talking to?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the one thing we can say for sure is that a lot of governments in other places, or at least some governments in other places, are looking at this. Finland, Uganda, Ontario, Canada, governments there are looking at it. Plus, we have private industry looking at it in Oakland, California. So it is a question on a lot of people's minds.
This was somewhat aided and abetted by Mark Zuckerberg, isn't it, because of what he said during his commencement remarks in May to, I forgot what school, but I remember thinking, wonder if that's going to fuel a lot of discussion about this.
Well, yes, Mark Zuckerberg did talk about it at a Harvard commencement address, and he's one of the people who has been talking about this. So it is on a lot of people's minds.
And what about your boss, Piero Midyar, not boss, but at least someone who is very instrumental in having brought CivilBeat out?
Yes, our publisher, Piero Midyar, is financing a pilot program in Kenya, looking at sort of universal basic income that's, again, in studying it and trying to figure out how it will work. So, yes, he also is looking at it.
So in all of these examples that may yield some data in the coming years, we may get a different idea of what it may mean for people in Hawaii, given the fact that we're kind of out here on our own. It's not as if you can drive to the next county to find another job. Is there a next step that, from the people that you've talked to, they see?
The next step really is to start a conversation, and that's what everybody says. Again, we have a lot of entities involved. What was interesting to me is talking to people, groups like labor organizations are interested in it, and the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce is interested in this. So we have diverse groups looking at this and very interested in it.
And so are we. We'll talk about it more, I'm sure. Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from CivilBeat.org, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. A state-by-state scorecard ranking how states rank in all matters related to long-term care shows Hawaii is again in the top 10. While that's good news, the report says all states, even the ones doing well, need to pick up the pace to keep up with aging baby boomers. Now, the first of the boomers will hit 80 in 10 years. The long-term care scorecard specifically considers long-term care services and supports for older adults, people with physical disabilities, and family caregivers. The scorecard is compiled by the AARP Foundation, the AARP Public Policy Institute, the SCAN Foundation, and the Commonwealth Fund, Craig Gima is a spokesperson for AARP Hawaii, and he joins us now. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is, you know, a piece of good news, but it's good news with a caveat, really, because we're seeing baby boomers aging and, well, I mean, everybody's aging, but getting to the point where they may be needing more help. The fact that we have such long life that we're blessed with in Hawaii, and many families who accept the fact that aging at home for their loved ones is going to, by necessity, for cost and other reasons, be what they're facing. So how do we take some of these very good points, we're number seven on the list, move them into what we need to do in future?
Well, the thing to consider is that not just the baby boomers are a big bubble of people, right? So as they become hit the 80s, there's more and more likelihood that that they're going to need some kind of long-term care or long-term care support. Doesn't necessarily mean everybody's not going to be that way. People take care of themselves, and people live long and healthy lives without needing care, but the chances are greater. And because it's a bubble, at the end of the bubble is a dip. And so the number of caregivers who are available to help people in their 80s and older is going to lessen. Right now, there's a ratio of about 6 to 1. For everybody who's of age where they need care, there are 6 potential caregivers, family caregivers. In a few years, that number is going to drop to 3 to 1. And by 2050, that number is going to drop to 2 to 1. So there's a real need to kind of improve to get the workforce up there so that there are options. And people overwhelmingly want to age at home. They don't want to age in a nursing home. And a nursing home is expensive, really expensive, out of the reach of middle class.
You're talking north of $130,000 if you're sharing a room to maybe $150,000.
$120,000 to $130,000 to share a room, over $140,000 for a private room, more than $11,000 a month. Most people can't afford that.
No, of course not. But the fact that you talk about how do we care for elders, there's also implicit in that argument, too. How are we going to care for ourselves? Because we have a whole group of millennials who are now in their late 30s. And in 20 years, this is going to start to be a real reality for them, too, either in caring for someone, right, being one of those one of two, or saying, hey, we better start thinking about it ourselves.
And it's not just the people who need care, but the caregivers. They need help, too. And so there is some progress. I mean, the report does show that Hawaii ranking in the top 10. And our spending on home care is increasing compared to our Medicaid spending on nursing home care. So that's a positive trend.
How much are we spending, roughly?
I don't have the exact figure, but I think we're up 12% year over the last time we had the report, which shows that the trend is that more money, more resources are going to home care, and that's a good thing because nursing home care is
so expensive.
That's
where most people need it.
Yeah, and that's where most people need it. So we want that trend to continue and want to accelerate because more needs to be done to help home family caregivers.
In this latest iteration of this report, which has only been out since 2012, 2013, this shows some real progress, too, in help for family caregivers. And we saw a lot of that push come through the CARE Act that was signed into law, which will go into effect July 1st.
Right. The CARE Act, was passed last year unanimously by the legislature and signed by the governor. The CARE Act helps family caregivers when their loved one goes into the hospital. It gives them 3 rights. Basically, the patient can designate a family caregiver on their medical record. So that family caregiver, too, has to be notified when they're discharged or transferred to another facility like a nursing home. And 3, and this is the most important, is it requires the hospitals to offer training and training on how to care for the person after they go home. Because that oftentimes, when you go home, it's you still have to administer medications. Sometimes it's a feeding tube. Sometimes you might have to give an injection or give an injection into an IV. And if you've never done these kinds of things before, it's a little intimidating. And so you have to get that training. The hospitals have to offer that training. And I think one of the messages here, too, is that people need to not be afraid to ask questions. If the hospital says this, and you don't really understand, speak up.
That's really tough for people, particularly some people here who are told, don't put your head up too high. Just say yes, yes, yes. Even if you go, I have no clue what I'm doing. I'll find out later.
So the CARE Act gives you a little ammunition there. Basically, if you're not really sure what's going on, the law says they have to let you know. They have to offer that training.
Between now and the next time that this scorecard is out and we're seeing the rankings, what will increase Hawaii's ability to score better?
Well, the CARE Act helped us in our score. That pushed up us.
That's
up
this time
bit.
Around. But between now and the next time,
we need
have
to continue
to
see more money going towards home-based care and support for caregivers. I think that's the biggest factor, really. That's where the need is the greatest, and I think that's where the state needs to focus their efforts.
For a very simple fact that, realistically speaking, in a small place as is Hawaii, and the fact that we can't put somebody in perhaps another county and drive over to be able to see and monitor and do all that kind of thing, you're really talking about people having to get their minds around. You're going to have people aging at home, in your home. What do you have to do to prepare for that? What do you have to change in your home to make it appropriate for someone?
Obviously, you know, the round door handles. That's like really, if you're getting older, you need those not knobs, but
those
levers.
You push them down.
The levers. Yeah. That's a simple change. It makes a big difference because most as you older, it's just harder to turn that round knob, and if you have a lever, it's easier. There are contractors now that specialize in adapting homes to make it easier to live at home. And I think that trend is going to continue because more people are living at home. And these homes weren't built for people as they age. And so many homes need modification.
And the question is, will there be some help for the homeowner as he or she is doing this to be able to accommodate a loved one?
I think that involves planning. Yeah. I mean, I think you need to start the conversation about, okay, with your parents, before they're sick, before they can't say what's going to happen, you know, if a stroke happens, they won't be able to talk for themselves. You need to talk to your parents ahead of time, like way ahead of time, about what they want, what their needs are, what monies they might have, what monies you might have, how you're going to pay for it. All these things can happen like years in advance, and it makes such a big difference to know what their parent wants.
Craig, I wish we had more time to talk. Thank you for coming in. At least it's a bit of good news and also a warning and a caveat for a lot of people. Take good care and make some real plans.
And then you'll have information on our we have some caregiving workshops.
We do, but I understand they're sold out, but we'll have lots of information.
Well, on the Neighbor Islands, on July 8th and July 15th.
All right. We'll have all that out so you can get even more
ARPHawaii.org. ARP.org/Hawaii.
Okay. Thank you. Craig Gima is a spokesperson for ARP Hawaii.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet, also what we can look for in our dark island skies. Returning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, as usual, we welcome him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers look out for Mars in the western sky, close to the sun during sunset. Jupiter and Saturn will also be visible in the southern sky right through till the early morning. The moon this week is passing through its new moon phase. This means a glorious return to dark skies here in the islands, perfect for stargazing.
And this week we're going to learn about some research that's being done relating to objects on the edge of the solar system.
Yes, indeed. Astronomers at the Gemini Observatory atop Mauna Kea have been working with another Mauna Kea observatory, the CFHT, or Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, in order to observe some of the most enigmatic objects in the solar system, the Kuiper Belt objects. What they observed is that the planet Neptune has been giving a gentle gravitational push to many of these objects, sending them on their way into the cold, dark depths of the outer solar system.
And first, before we hear about that, how about just a little background on what the Kuiper Belt is?
Well, the Kuiper Belt is named after the astronomer Gerard Kuiper. It's kind of like the asteroid belt, except it's out beyond the orbit of Neptune. And it's made up of ancient objects that were once the building blocks of the solar system.
And these are probably really cold places. I'm imagining everything's frozen.
Oh, yeah, totally. Everything out here is like giant ice cubes. Except they're too big to fit in your glass. Oh, and they're made of frozen gases like methane and ammonia, not the kind of stuff that I would like in my cocktail.
And so exactly what have they found?
Well, we've spotted what we are calling a blue binary. And it's not a star. These are actually frozen objects that were thought to have formed in the inner solar system, but then were pushed out to the edge by the planets such as Neptune. As you know, these objects are really cool. Get it? By studying them, we get an idea of what conditions in the early solar system were like. It enables us to peer through a window into our ancient past to a time when the Earth was nothing more than a collection of boulders. boulders that were sculpted and pummeled into the beautiful planet we live on today.
Christopher Phillips and another exciting Stargazer report. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the first Polynesian person to travel into Oregon's backcountry during its territorial days. Weren't expecting that, were you? We accompanied explorer David Thompson on a voyage up the Columbia and helped to establish the Pacific Fur Company's first inland post, this person we're talking about here. That post was called Spokane House. Now, later this person's travels on behalf of the company took him to Montana, across the continent to Montreal, over the Atlantic to England, and eventually all the way around the globe back to the Pacific. He was known as John Cox, though back at home he went by Naukane. That's the answer to today's quiz. And if you've got one you'd like us to pose, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Karen Gast has a highly responsible full-time job on Hawaii Island where she lives, but more importantly for our purposes right now, she and her partner Sean Crawford have been brewing beers, meads, and ciders for over 20 years. They are longtime members of the Kona Barley Boys. This long-established craft brewing club on Hawaii Island is a nexus for home brews there, and that's why we're visiting with Karen today.
We have lived on the Big Island for 12 years, but in reality, the homebrew scene started with a gentleman by the name of Rocket Rod Romanak and his wife, Cheryl. Back in 1984, I think, is when they started the Kona Coast Barley Boys and started selling homebrew supplies. And they did it out of, you know, the farmer's market. And to this day, we have a monthly meeting with the Kona Coast Barley Boys, and we go from home to home of different island brewers, and people are invited to come and bring something they've brewed or maybe something that they've picked up on the mainland that's special and talk story about brewing and about, you know, what challenges we have and what successes we've had.
About how many people are brewing there on your island?
How many?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
What do you think?
I think our list for just the west side is about 120 emails.
Okay.
Not everybody's brewing, but everybody is interested in it.
Uh-huh.
And then you have on the east side, you have the Orchid Isle Ailers. and that is, we're just kind of one big group, but because we're so far away from each other, sometimes we don't get to meet up every month.
I heard about the Kona competition that was in March.
Uh-huh.
Anything exciting come out there?
Oh, yeah. I think we had about 150 entries.
Oh.
And they came from mostly the islands, which is awesome.
Uh-huh.
And then some from California, some from Arizona, some from different parts of the mainland. All of our judges are registered and certified by the national certification program.
What did they have to say about your beers?
Oh, well, we won a couple silvers, but the one, so we do two separate things. We do meads and ciders, and then we do beers. So a local boy, Mike Franchini, won for his beer, and then a lady out of Hilo won for her mead. So they actually won round trip tickets on Mokulele from the brew festival.
Well, the whole thing sounds kind of scrappy and fun, actually.
Well, that's the great thing about home brewing is you get to make beers. I mean, there's guidelines of how different beers should taste and what characteristics they should have. But basically, it's like making food. You get to make it how it's interesting and tastes for you. So you get to tweak it so it suits what you like.
Are you noticing any trends in Hawaii-made beer?
Yeah, I think, well, nationally, sour beers have gotten more popular. But then also still the IPAs and some more of the flavored beers. So, like, we do a Lilikoi pale ale.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the struggles we have is getting different yeasts and everything on time. So that's been a challenge. But I think everybody's just really discovering, you know, what they like, and they submit it for judging just to see how it compares to what other palates are out there, you know, what other people are tasting.
Sure.
So that they can refine their beers.
Are there any particular difficulties doing it on a neighbor island?
Well, I think all the islands, getting equipment, because if you want to brew in larger batches, you know, you have to have stainless steel pots and burners and all this lovely equipment that's readily available and easily shipped on the mainland. Gets a little expensive to ship to the Big Island and to Oahu and mm-hmm. to the neighbor islands.
How much do you brew per batch, Karen?
Well, we brew about 12 gallons at a time, but we have friends that mm-hmm. have larger systems that can brew up to 50 gallons.
Whoa, that's quite a bit, right? That set you up
quite
for a while.
Bit. When we do that, we'll do a big batch. We usually split it up between people, or we will put it in a bourbon barrel to age.
Mm.
So those would be for bigger beers like stouts and porters and barley wines.
Boy, I'm just really getting tantalized by the range that you're able to produce out there. What's the cutting edge of home brewing these days?
The cutting edge. I think it's probably yeast strains. So there's a lot of big breweries keep their own yeast and propagate their own yeast to make the specific beers that they want to do. It's kind of like you have your own little secret recipe.
Mm-hmm.
So cutting edge would be basically being able to propagate your own yeast from, say, other people's beers that have a yeast sediment at the bottom, and then taking that little bit of yeast and trying to make it grow so that you can recreate, say, a specialty commercial beer that you really enjoy.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
So yeah, it's very scientific at point. And then sometimes it's just, you know, throw caution to the wind and, hey, I've got this kind of hops. I've never tried this before. Let's throw them in and let's see what happens. You know, we'll taste it in 3 weeks and see where it goes.
It's bound to be good.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, it's always a challenge, but it's always a joy to create something new and then have some friends over and mm-hmm. talk story and have a few libations and yeah. enjoy the sunset.
And I know the Hilo competition's coming up too.
Yeah, they will also be doing a homebrew competition, and I think they judge on Thursday and Friday before the festival also.
I see. You expect it to be good? I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always, you know, it's always fun to go, and you never know what you're going to get.
What's a good way for people to connect with your group?
We have a Facebook page for the homebrew competition, and it's called, on Facebook, it's Rocket Rod Homebrew Competition. And then Brew Hawaii is Ross Fuller, and he's on the east side of Hawaii.
Okay, you're connecting us with the Hawaii
Absolutely.
Island scene. Well, I can't wait to get over and taste some of your tipsifying concoctions, Karen. Thank you so much.
Okay, you bet. You have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Karen Gast, Hawaii Island home brewer, reminds us the Hilo Brew Fest, a fundraiser for Hilo Rotarians, is set for June 24th at the Wainaku Executive Center. All right, Derek Malama, Morning Edition host, and my colleague here. Thanks for stopping by, Derek.
Of course.
No, what's going on? We may not have noticed.
Okay, this would be under the radar. Hui No'eau Visual Arts Center on Maui is celebrating the 100th anniversary of a famous mansion. And I learned a lot doing this segment, actually. Yeah. I learned about C.W. Dickey.
Uh-huh.
Yes. He's the architect.
Famous Dickey Roof.
Right. Mm-hmm. He's the architect who designed the Halekulani Hotel, mm-hmm. also buildings for Kamehameha Schools, a volcano house on the Big Island, and many others. He also designed the Kalua Nui Estate on Maui in 1917 for Harry and Ethel Baldwin. And Hui No'eau in Makawao is celebrating the estate's centennial with an exhibit called 10 by 10. And this exhibit challenges artists to create 2D and 3D works in a defined space of 10 by 10 by 10 inches. 100 pieces were selected for, you know, because it's the 100th
right.
anniversary for this display, which ends on July 22nd.
Oh, that's great. And so much fun up there at Hui No'eau. Mm-hmm. What else is happening, Derek?
The Aloha International Piano Festival is taking place in Honolulu this week. And guest artists Fabio Bidini and John Nakamatsu will conduct a joint workshop tomorrow focusing on the topic of how to teach differently. Now, did you ever take piano lessons?
I did.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. No. It's kind of trombone lessons. So it's a little
we got to get together
there.
Sometime.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, the piano festival is always a great time. And John Nakamatsu, great friend of the islands. These people do master classes that so many enjoy.
Yes.
Derek, thanks again for taking us kind of behind the scenes here and getting us under the radar with some of these great happenings. Really appreciate it. Look forward to you tomorrow.
Okay.
And by the way, this is a perfect segment for you because despite being the host of Morning Edition and the host of ever-popular Kani Kapila Sunday, you yourself are a little under the radar, Derek. It's a local talent.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
And we're coming up to the top of the hour, so we need to say goodbye at least until tomorrow. A recent report shows that single older women in Hawaii face serious economic challenges. But what does all this mean for their younger counterparts? We'll talk with Dr. Colette Brown of UH School of Social Work.
And that Masikaha Hawaii case, it won't go away and maybe it shouldn't. We'll take a look at a poetic take on that. And we'll visit the Maui Film Festival.
You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org if you'd like us to know something. Or you can check out, just check out the website. You'll find lots of good stuff there.
I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow with more of The Conversation.